Now, in Genesis chapter 33, which we finished in our last session, we finally got Jacob saved. He was the subject of several chapters, and God was working on him. Actually, God had stated his intentions for Jacob, or at least for Jacob's people, even prior to Jacob's birth, to Abraham and to Isaac, and even while Jacob and his twin brother were in the womb, even to Rebekah, God had indicated that Jacob was specially chosen above his brother Esau for special purposes. Well, in the chapters that we've studied in the last few sessions, we've seen that Jacob was not always the man who we think of as a man of God. He was a greedy man. He was not all that godly toward his brother, toward his father. He had to go sort of through the meat grinder to get broken down, and that meat grinder was in the house of his uncle Laban for 20 years. And he did get broken down a fair bit. Not completely, until God wrestled with him all night and finally broke him of his self-confidence and brought him to the point where he knew he could not care for his own needs ultimately and begged God for blessing. His name was changed to Israel, and by the end of that chapter, that is, by the end of chapter 33, verse 20, he is calling God, God the God of Israel. That is his own God. He has never prior to this referred to God as his God. Although he has referred to God, he's only called him the God of my father Isaac, or the fear of my father Isaac, or the God of Abraham, but never yet the God of Jacob or the God of Israel. Until the end of this chapter. Now, really the main concern for most of the rest of the book of Genesis is going to be with one of Jacob's sons, who is Joseph. But there are some scraps, little bits of family anecdotal history about Jacob, or that happened prior to the story of Joseph, that will be filled in the next several chapters, chapter 34 and 35, and 36 almost seem like an appendix to the life of Jacob, at least to my mind they do. They do not carry forward his spiritual odyssey any further, as far as I can tell. It's with one possible exception. It's possible that in chapter 35 Jacob makes a further step of obedience to God, but even chapter 35 just seems to have some winding down the story, some repetition of the things God told him before. The death of Rachel is going to be there, a reiteration of the names of his 12 sons, and then his own, the death of his father Isaac. Now, and then chapter 36 is really just the genealogy of Esau, whose genealogy is given there because he's going to be dismissed permanently from the narrative after that point. So we have here what I would consider to be sort of an appendix, although that does not mean that there's nothing important in these chapters. It's just that we're not really studying now further developments in God's dealings with Jacob quite to the same extent as the narrative prior to this in the last several chapters did. Chapter 34 is a story about Jacob's daughter Dinah. Now, we don't know if she was the only daughter of Jacob. She is the only one who is named, but it's possibly the case that she is the only one who is ever named because she's the only one about whom any story or significant events occurred that were worthy of relating in the Scripture. We were introduced to her back in the chapters where we were reading of the many children being born to the various wives of Jacob. And we read how that after Leah had had six sons, she also bore a daughter whose name was Dinah. That is mentioned in chapter 30 and verse 21. And this story is about Dinah. Now, we don't know where this story exactly falls chronologically. It probably follows all the chapters we've read before rather than flashes back to some earlier period. But we don't know how much. If it was immediately after the chapter before, Dinah wouldn't be more than about 7 years old. And given the details and the way the story goes, it seems like we're talking about a girl who is older than 7 years old. Although I say that largely because there is a man who takes sexual advantage of her and then wants to marry her, and to our minds 7 years old seems a little young. for that kind of thing to be happening to a girl, though in some societies, Muhammad, for example, married an 8-year-old girl. He had several wives, but his favorite was an 8-year-old girl when he married her. And so in the Middle East, maybe 7 years old wouldn't be too young. I just heard in the news day before yesterday of an 8-year-old girl who's pregnant. She reached puberty at age 5 and is pregnant by some neighbor boys at age 8. This is obviously a fluke and probably more due to the hormones in modern foods that we eat, the female hormones in the meat and in the milk that cause girls sometimes to freakishly mature too young. But even in ancient times, even hundreds of years ago, as I say, Muhammad married an 8-year-old. And so maybe Shechem, the man in this story, might have been interested in a girl who was 7 or 8. But we don't have to assume that. We just don't know how much time has elapsed since the previous chapter. It says, now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. Jacob and Leah should have been more protective as parents. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and violated her. His soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman and spoke kindly to the young woman. So Shechem spoke to his father, Hamor, saying, give me this young woman as a wife. And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with his livestock in the field, so Jacob held his peace until they came. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. And the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it. And the men were grieved and very angry because he had done this disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing which ought not to be done. Notice the expression in verse 7, in Israel, a term that we would normally understand to be with reference to in the nation of Israel today. But Israel was just the name of Jacob at this point. That was all. But his family apparently was at this point, in the manner of speaking, in Israel. His family was Israel because they were the children of Israel. And we know that the term children of Israel later on was simply a synonym for Israel. So Israel was the man. His family were the children of Israel, or more concisely, the whole family was called Israel at this point, so that his daughter was also in Israel. Now, we are not told whether Dinah was a consenting party to the sexual encounter that is described here. There are many who feel that she was raped, but there's not the slightest indication of that to my reading of the passage. As a matter of fact, the man himself does not strike me as a rapist type. He was prince of the country and would not have to endanger his status and his reputation, his dignity, by going out and raping a girl. In many cases, a prince could have a harem of all the girls he wanted legitimately. He would not have to do something so endangering to his status and to his reputation as to go out and rape somebody just because he had passion. Furthermore, he's not described as a man who acted merely out of passion. It says his soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, and this afterwards as well, apparently. And he wanted to marry her. He wanted to make it an honorable thing. This is so much in contrast to Amnon, one of David's sons, who raped his sister Tamar. Prior to his raping her, it said he loved her so much it made him sick. But after he raped her, he hated her and didn't want ever to look at her again. That is much more like a circumstance where rape, which is obviously an act of aggression, an act of violation, it's an act of violence. Some people want to be emphatic in saying that rape is not an act of passion, it's an act of violence. Well, possibly, and certainly in many cases it is. But the point is, this man is not behaving like a rapist. He's behaving like a man who has a relationship with this woman. We don't ever read of what her feelings toward him were in the entire story. He has, however, kept him in her home. She hasn't come home to her father. Because the wording of verse 17 and verse 26 later on in this chapter seem to indicate Dinah, even during these negotiations, was still in Shechem's home. He kept her because he hoped to marry her. Now, there's not necessarily any reason to believe he kidnapped her or kept her against her will. She went to his land on her own. She went to visit the daughters of the land. Now, this was kind of a stupid thing for her to do and rather stupid for her parents to allow. obviously. I mean, you can see from reading it what kind of people they were. The Canaanites, and these were Canaanites, were idolatrous and they were immoral. There's so many parents of Christian children. Christian parents have lost their children, that is, lost the hearts of their children and the innocence of their children by simply allowing them to go out and associate with the pagans on the assumption that this is normal sociability. And that parents who protect their children from pagan society or from untested, even religious society, they're considered to be overprotective, they're considered to be paranoid or whatever. We ourselves know of many cases of children who were violated in Sunday school or by people they met in Sunday school. We know parents who homeschool and would never send their children to be corrupted in public school, but their children got corrupted through friends they met in Sunday school because the parents were not attentive and they assumed that the children there were safe to be with. Now, why did Jacob and Leah allow their daughter to go visit the daughters of the land, a land where the daughters, if they had any religious convictions at all, were corrupt, pagan, probably infant sacrificing, since that's what the Canaanites generally did, worshippers of Moloch, and where she would be vulnerable to the men of the land who would have no godly morals whatsoever, taking advantage as they did. Now, again, we don't read that she was taken advantage of in the sense of raped. She may have formed an emotional attachment to this young man. There is no evidence to the contrary. If he had forced her against her will, kicking and screaming, as one would picture if she was not emotionally attached to him, then, as I say, this would be seen more as an act of violence and aggression, and it doesn't seem to jibe very well with his general fondness for her and desire to make it honorable and legal and so forth. And furthermore, it even says later on in the chapter that this young man, and it's a strange thing to say about a man who just had immoral relations with the girl, but it says that he was more honorable than all the household of his father. It says that in verse 19 of this chapter. This young man, well, I mean, the reason for saying this was to convey the notion that he was not a real, real bad guy. His house of his father may not have been the greatest, but he was more honorable than the rest. As it turns out, he was actually more honorable than Dinah's family, too, because Shechem and Levi, her brothers, actually proved to be deceivers and murderers themselves. Shechem is actually eulogized in this chapter as a not a good guy, not a good man, but more honorable than most of his town. And this would hardly even be necessary to mention if he was being portrayed here as a rapist. It's more likely that in his society, morals were more lax. I doubt if there's been any society where rape was considered not to be a crime, but extramarital sex in pagan circumstances often is not considered to be wrong, and that's probably what we have here. She probably was wooed. She probably fell for the guy. She probably was attracted to him. Whether she approved of going as far as they went or not, we don't know. But I'm saying that the problem arose here largely because of Jacob and Leah's parenting. Now, modern Christians, if they hear me say that, especially parents of teenagers, would normally say, "Oh, you're just naive. You can't keep them down on the farm. You know, you can't control who your children are influenced by. You cannot guarantee that your children, just because they're raised in a godly home, we'll pick up godly values and we'll stay out of trouble." Well, no, it's true. You can't assume that unless you take precautions. The Bible does say, train up a child in the way that it should go. And the Bible certainly indicates that parents have a duty to guide their children. And guiding children has to do with not only telling them where they can go, but where they can't go. And we have a society today that assumes that children, once they reach, I guess, the age that they're able to think and have opinions of their own, ought to be allowed to follow their own opinions and their own tastes and go where they want to go and do what they want to do. And parents who don't let them do it are too restrictive and too protective and too paranoid and so forth. And guess what? Our society operates on that assumption, and look what happens. I doubt that a very large percentage of young girls are virgins when they get married in our society. I don't know what the percentage is. I'm not sure if anyone knows what the percentage is, but just instinctively, from my knowledge of people that I meet, and even godly people that I meet, most of the godly people I know, sadly, were not virgins when they got married. Either because they weren't godly in their younger years, or even they were godly, but they compromised. And this is indicative of something wrong in our society, and no one seems to be putting two and two together. I was looking at a book this morning that was talking about the generation gap, and it was talking about causes of the generation gap, and it was talking about all these sociological and psychological factors in children when they reach a certain age that causes the generation gap. It's a simple matter of history. There was no generation gap before there was public school. Ever since the mandatory public education came along about 100 years ago, there has been a new subculture or new counterculture among youth about every 15 years. And by sending children off into the pagan world to associate with pagan kids, what happens, of course, is in their vulnerable years, while children are young and impressionable and immature and insecure and looking for a support group, if the family is not there for them because they've been sent out of the home, the peer group becomes the family, becomes the people upon whom they become emotionally dependent, and it becomes necessary for them, they feel, to please their peers. You see, when children are raised at home, it is much more important to them to please their family. That's their support society, is their family, to please their parents. But when you send them out of the home at age 5 or 6, when the children are still groping for some sense of security, some sense of identity, and they can't identify with the family anymore because they're not with their family very often. They don't spend many hours with their parents, but they spend a lot of hours with these other kids, and so they find a way to merge with this new identity with their peers. And this has happened ever since the policy of sending children to school occurred about 100 years ago in our society. And sure enough, parents say, I don't know what happened. The kids don't have my values. I don't understand why it doesn't matter to them my opinion anymore. And, they just can't seem to put it together. This article I was reading about the causes of the generation gap didn't even mention this. That the generation gap is a product of sending children away to school. Something that simply wasn't done a century ago. Christian families have just come to the place where they assume in our society you send your children off to be with the pagans. Or, if you realize now, and many Christians do, that public school is a very bad place, and people get shot there and raped there and other bad things happen there, and they meet very bad people there, many Christians send their kids now to Christian schools where they meet pagans there. And the worst part of sending them to Christian school, I'm not saying that there's nothing good about Christian school, but one thing that's very dangerous is that your guard is more down when you're at a Christian school because you assume you're now not in a pagan environment. And the fact of the matter is that a Christian school does have this characteristic. Virtually all the parents of the children are Christian. But it's also the case in Christian schools that the majority of kids very often are not personally committed to Christ, which means that the same mistake is being made. You're assuming that because Christians, the teachers and the parents are Christians, that the kids are either Christians or at least it's a Christian environment. I, for one, would have to say that I did not pick up my values in public school from my teachers. I picked them up from my peers. I was very much peer influenced. Fortunately, not entirely, but much too much. And I was corrupted much more by being in public school than I would have been had I been trained in the under the oversight of my parents. But it was just considered to be, A, too inconvenient to protect your kids that much. It requires too much parental attention, too much parental time, too much parental dedication. And secondly, it was considered to be kind of paranoid. You know, well, what's wrong with you? Why are you being so antisocial? Why don't you send your kids to the Sunday school class? Why don't you send your kids to the public school? What's wrong with our kids? Aren't they good enough for your kids? What's the matter? You guys too good for us? And this kind of social pressure has made everyone just assume, well, I don't want to do anything. Don't want to rock the boat. Don't want to do anything antisocial. The fact of the matter is Christian parents should be aware that they must supervise the society, be selective and supervise the society of their children for a very long time. I'd say into the teenage years. Probably through the teenage years. In fact, in biblical times, it was until they were married. That's very strange in our society because I never would have dreamed of staying home until I got married. I left home when I was 17 because I was out of school. My parents said I could leave then, and I did. And I didn't get married for some years after that. But in biblical times, the parents protected the environment of the children until they had a spouse to and a new home to protect them. The world is a dangerous place for children. And parents are supposed to protect them. And no, it's not that our children are too good for other people, it's that they're not good enough. If they were too good, we wouldn't be worried about the influence of other people. If our children were so good that they were consistently and seamlessly godly in all their attitudes, and then no, there would be no danger. The reason for withholding them is not because they're too good, it's because they're not good enough, because they're susceptible. And Christians need to avoid the social pressure that is put on them to simply release their children to preschool or kindergarten or to other school. Frankly, I mean, I don't want to condemn people who, for various reasons, have to send their children to some other kind of schooling. I think those people are very few in number, the ones who really need to. I think an awful lot of people say, well, we just can't afford to live on one income. Well, then change your lifestyle. There's lots of people who manage it. Really, one should say, we can't live at our desired standard of living on one income. But if that's really the case, and that is, of course, with these people who say we can't live on one income, then we might ask, then is your desired standard of living more important than the souls of your children? Apparently it is with many people. Jacob and Leah did probably what was normally done with kids. Yeah, she's big enough to, you know, she's not going to go out and get eaten by a bear. She can wander around on her own. Let her go and visit the girls of the land. Even though every one of them's corrupt, there's not a worshiper of Jehovah in the whole city of Shechem. They're all Moloch worshipers. They're all pagans with pagan morality standards and so forth. And they let her go in. And one of the best of them, the most noble in the city, the prince, he has sex with her. Which tells you something about the general moral level of the city itself. And it's not surprising when we study what Canaanite society was like. What's amazing is not that this girl got in trouble when she went to Shechem. What's amazing is her parents, who knew about the society of Shechem, allowed her to go there. And Jacob really has to bear a fair bit of responsibility for the defilement of his daughter. Now, amazingly, the man who slept with her wanted to marry her and kept her in his home and sent his father and came with his father to negotiate a marriage between the fathers. Jacob heard about it. He was upset about it, but he didn't say anything. He held his peace until his sons came. Remember how that Laban and Bethuel, the father and brother of Rebekah, had been jointly negotiating the marriage of Rebekah. So apparently in that society, the older sons had some role, some shared responsibility in the disposition of the marriage of their sisters. And so Jacob waited for her brothers to come in. Now she had six brothers, full brothers, that were of her same mother, Leah. The oldest ones were Reuben and Simeon and Levi. Reuben does not figure in this story. I'm not sure exactly why he was not that involved, but Simeon and Levi, the next two oldest brothers, are very, very aggressive in participating in these negotiations. It says in verse 8, "But Hamor spoke with them, saying, 'The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him as a wife, and make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us, and take our daughters to yourselves. So you shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade in it, and acquire possessions for yourselves in it.' Then Shechem said to her father and her brothers, 'Let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me I will give. Ask me ever so much dowry and gift, and I will give according to what you say to me. But give me the young woman as a wife.' But the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor his father and spoke deceitfully, because he had defiled Dinah their sister. And they said to them, 'We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a reproach to us. But on this condition we will consent to you. If you will become as we are, if every male of you is circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you, we will take your daughters to us. And we will dwell with you, and we will become one people. But if you will not heed us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and be gone.'" And their words pleased Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son, which is astonishing. Those words wouldn't please me very much if I was Hamor or Shechem. Of course, I'm sure you've read ahead to know how this story turns out. And these two boys who made these two young men who made this arrangement and insisted on the whole city being circumcised, they, of course, took advantage of that as an opportunity to slaughter the city. But it seems that Hamor and Shechem would be suspicious about this. They were not asking permission for all of their men to marry Dinah or to marry freely among Jacob's daughters generally, if there were others. But rather, they were just asking for one marriage. And it seems that they could have thought, well, wait a minute. We're only asking for Shechem to marry this girl. If you don't want her to marry an uncircumcised man, then he can be circumcised. But why all the men of the city? It seems clear that the request was a bit overextensive. I mean, there's certainly no reason. But I guess what the implication was is that we don't want our daughter, we don't want our sister, living in a pagan society. The paganism of the Canaanites would be seen in their uncircumcised condition. And it's not so much that it's just her husband, but she's going to live in Shechem. She's going to live in the society, and we don't want to deliver our daughter over to a society that's so totally unclean. And therefore, if you would all circumcise yourselves, it would suggest possibly an adoption of perhaps the Jewish religion, or at least of some Jewish notions of propriety, and you reform your society a little bit in general, and we won't feel so uncomfortable about our sister Dinah or our other daughters, for that matter, marrying among you guys. We can intermarry between the two. We can be one people, they said. And so Shechem and Hamor agreed to this. So the young man did not delay to do the thing because he delighted in Jacob's daughter. He was more honorable than all the household of his father. And Hamor and Shechem, his son, came to the gate of their city and spoke with the men of their city, saying, this was at the gate of the city because all legal transactions generally occurred there. These men are at peace with us, they said. Boy, that was a miscalculation. Therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade in it, for indeed the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us as wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only on this condition will the men consent to dwell with us and to be one people, if every male among us is circumcised as they are circumcised. Will not their livestock, their property, and every animal of theirs be ours? Only let us consent to them, and they will dwell with us. And all who went out of this gate of the city heeded Hamor and Shechem, his son. Every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of the city. Now, this matter of will not their livestock and property and every animal of theirs be ours is not necessarily reflective of Shechem's actual motives. But he has to find some reason to get the people to agree with him. I mean, he is the king, and the prince could make the demand. But, I mean, there are certain demands that if the king or prince made, it might cause a general revolution or general revolt. And I would think this would be one of those things. You know, if the king said, okay, we got a new law here, everybody has to be circumcised as adults. I imagine there'd be enough people saying, hey, I'm not very interested in that. you can be circumcised if you want to marry this Jewish girl, but I'm not in love with the Jewish girl right now. In fact, my wife likes me just fine the way I am. And I don't have a strong incentive, like you do, to circumcise myself. And so Hamor and Shechem had to find some way to create an incentive. You know, I mean, Shechem had incentive enough just because he was in love, but these other men were not in love with Dinah or with Jacob's daughters. But he could say, listen, look at the long-term benefits to our society. These people are rich. I mean, Jacob is like a separate city. A chieftain of a powerful clan, lots of livestock and servants and all that stuff. And if we intermarry, then our sons will inherit, you know, their stuff. It's like their wealth will be merged with ours into a much larger, more powerful economic society. Well, this apparently resonated with the people, and they agreed to go along with it. Verse 25, now it came to pass on the third day, when they were in pain, that two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came boldly upon the city and killed all the males. And they killed Hamor and Shechem his son with the edge of the sword, and they took Dinah from Shechem's house and went out. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city because their sister had been defiled. They took their sheep, their oxen, and their donkeys, what was in the city and what was in the field, and all their wealth, all their little ones, and their wives they took captive, and they plundered even all that was in their houses. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Since I am few in number, they will gather themselves together against me and kill me. I shall be destroyed, my household and I." But they said, "Should he treat our sister like a harlot?" Now these men give evidence of the need for laws like those that Moses later would give. Under the law of Moses, if a man slept with a girl who is not his wife, there were two possibilities. If she was neither married nor betrothed to another, he'd have to marry her. If she was either betrothed or married, he and she would be put to death. Unless, in her case, it had been out in a rural situation where she might have screamed for help and no one came, in which case she'd be given the benefit of the doubt, only the man would be put to death and the woman would be spared, under the law of Moses, which came later. In other words, there were just and equitable ways to deal with these kinds of affronts and these kinds of wrongs that were done. To go and even to kill a man for violating a virgin was not considered acceptable punishment in the law. Now, if a man slept with another man's wife or betrothed wife, that was punishable by death. But if the girl was a virgin, she was presumably marriageable. And if a man violated her, it could be redressed simply by marrying her. And that was, as I say, stated in the law later on in Exodus chapter 20, somewhere in between chapter 21 and 23. But to kill a man for violating a virgin was considered to be excessive. To kill a whole city because one man had violated a virgin is even more excessive. And yet this is so common, and this is why the law had to be given. Because it's so common in many ancient societies, in tribal societies, in Middle Eastern societies, family feuds and retributive slaughters and so forth, or civil wars, they're just the way that their culture operates. If you read many missionary books, you know that there's a lot of tribes, the Aucas, for example, or many of the tribes in the Pacific Islands, they just have a continuous tribal feuds, where one person from one family is killed by someone from another tribe, so somewhere down the line, unexpectedly, at some time, without notice, somebody from the offender's tribe is killed by someone from the offended tribe, and that just keeps going back and forth forever. It just escalates into continual, unrestrained, unjust, unregulated vengeance. And that is why the law at a later time would say an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. We sometimes think of that, oh, that's pretty severe, knocking a guy's eye out for an eye and tooth for a tooth. But that was actually a law that God gave to prevent the more common forms of retribution, which were more excessive. Even today in some Muslim lands, if you steal a loaf of bread, the punishment is to have your hand cut off. Nowadays they do it, you know, very high-tech. Today in Saudi Arabia, if you steal a loaf of bread, you will have your hand cut off. If you do certain other things more offensive, you'll have your head cut off. And at these executions or at these rituals where they actually do these things, they have a doctor there. When the hand is cut off, the doctor stops the bleeding. They rush the guy to the hospital so that he survives, but he lives without a hand. This, in the old days, they just used to whack it off, and if he bled to death, that was his tough luck. But even if he didn't bleed to death, he lived without a hand because he stole a piece of bread. Under the law of Moses, things were much more just. You steal a piece of bread, you replace it with two of the same to the owner. You make, in other words, restitution. Now, in the Middle East and in pagan lands in general, there is no innate sense of justice that would restrain outrageous and disproportionate reprisals like this. And therefore God gave a law which, when Moses gave it, he said to the Jewish people, don't ever lose this law. Don't ever violate it. This law will be your wisdom and your honor in the sight of all the nations around you who will say, wow, whoever, what people ever had a God so close as this God who gives them all these wonderful laws and ordinances and so just and perfect laws? Moses acknowledged that the laws that God gave the Jews were unique in that region and would be recognized as being far superior to what other societies had. And it's true. We don't often see it because we live in a society that has taken for granted much of the code of justice that was in the law of Moses. Our own legal systems in America and in England were derived very largely from the law of Moses to a large extent. And so we take it for granted. But when you read something like this, you might say, well, this is ghastly. You know, one person does one thing wrong to one person and the whole city is exterminated, all the men. And then the women and children are taken as slaves. That's horrendous. And indeed it is. It's absolutely horrendous. But no law had been given to restrict this kind of reprisals from occurring. And that's no doubt why the law is so highly revered in the scripture. Why David said, oh, how I love thy law. It is my meditation all the day. We think of the law as something oppressive because we're under grace, not under law. But the law was a wonderful thing to prevent this kind of thing from happening. Under this system, Levi and Simeon, under the law of Moses at a later time, would have been executed for what they did here. They should have been. Unfortunately, Jacob's parenting is weak, just like that of so many before him and after him, probably more of those after him. David, for example, and Eli and many others who are shown to be very poor parents. But Jacob rebukes them. That's all Eli did to his sons too when they were raping women at the altar. And David didn't even rebuke Absalom or Adonijah. But Jacob at least rebukes them, but that's not enough. Just to rebuke men when they should be executed is not justice. Jacob said to Simeon and Levi in verse 30, you have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land. Now, he rebukes them for what they did, but not because of its immorality. He doesn't even protest. You have done a horrendous deed before God. You deserve to die for killing all these innocent people. But he says, his whole complaint is, now I'm going to be in trouble because you did that. We do not outnumber all the people in this land. When they hear that we're this kind of a bloodthirsty family, they're going to gang up on us. They're going to come, as, you know, all their armies will get together and come after us and kill us and wipe us out. So Jacob here is not showing a very highly elevated moral indignation. He just gives them a slap on the wrist, as it were, and his reasons for doing so are not even commendable. He's just afraid of what's going to happen to him because of what they did. He should have been very severe with them. And they just slough it off by saying, well, should he treat our sister like a harlot? Well, what a stupid answer that is. Obviously, no one is saying that Shechem should treat their sister as a harlot. But that's a different issue. Shechem's sin is not even in the same ballpark with their sin. And they're being confronted about their sin and their wickedness, which was great. And they bring up, you know, a relatively minor thing compared to what they did as some kind of justification for their acts. By the way, we don't read of them ever being, of course, executed or dying for what they did here. But we do later read in chapter 49 of Genesis that when it comes to the birthright, they are excluded. And they're excluded because of what happened in this story, which is probably why the story is related. Because birthright normally goes to the oldest. Reuben was the oldest, and Simeon and Levi were the next. In a story we will read very shortly after this, we will find that Reuben did something very bad. He slept with his father's concubine, and that happens in the next chapter. And this becomes the reason that he, the oldest son, is excluded from the birthright. His immorality puts him out of the running for the birthright. And that leaves Simeon and Levi next in line as far as age is concerned, but they are excluded because of what they did here. All of these stories about Reuben and Simeon and Levi here are probably there to explain why Judah, the next oldest son, actually became the possessor of the birthright. Why it was that Judah actually became the birthright possessor? Because the three sons older than him, Reuben, Simeon, and Levi, all were disqualified for various sins on their part. This chapter being the story of why Simeon and Levi were later disqualified. Now chapter 35. Then God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there, and make an altar there to God, who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau your brother." And Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, "Put away the foreign gods that are among you. Purify yourselves and change your garments, and let us arise and go up to Bethel. And I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me in the way in which I have gone." Now, it says, so they gave all their foreign gods, these would be teraphim, or idols, excuse me, which were in their hands, and all their earrings, which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree, which is by Shechem. Now, again, Jacob is a man who has committed his life to God, but he's not really governing his household very wisely. He doesn't guard his daughter's purity very carefully. He doesn't discipline his sons, who do things murderously worthy of death. He doesn't discipline them adequately. And he hasn't even until this time even made sure that there aren't idols in the house. Now, I think we can probably assume he didn't have any personal idols, but he had many servants. He probably had hundreds of servants. We know that his wife Rachel had the teraphim of her father. He may have learned of it by this time. But the servants were not necessarily all godly people. He had probably gotten a lot of those over in Paddan Aram, a bunch of Syrians. And that being the case, probably some of them were idolaters. Most people were in the world at that time. And they had their little idols and fetishes and so forth. And he had not gotten those things out of his house prior to this. He could have. His slaves, you know, he could tell them to throw away their idols, but he just never had really lowered the boom before this. But the reason he is now is because God appears to him and says, "Go to Bethel. Build an altar to me in Bethel." Well, why there? What's going to happen there? Actually, we're not told very much about what happened at Bethel. We do read later in this chapter, he gets there and God reiterates to him things that were already told him earlier. But I have a suspicion that up till this time, Jacob had not fully fulfilled his promises to God, which he had made at Bethel. When he was fleeing from Esau, he made three promises to God. One was that, you know, if God would protect him, that he, Jacob, Jehovah could be his God. Well, that was already, Jacob already has acknowledged that to be so. Also, that the pillar or the stone there would be God's house. Well, there's not much more for him to do about that. But there's one other thing. He's supposed to give 10% to God. And how do you do that? Well, when we give 10% to God, we take actual, you know, money. We write a check and we give it to a missionary or to a church or to a rescue mission or to someone like that. But in those days, what you did is you take your livestock, which was your principal wealth, and you burn it. You burn it on an altar to God. You sacrifice it. So he was on his way to Bethel to, I think, fulfill a promise he had made and as yet unfulfilled. He had lots of livestock, probably thousands of head, and he had to sacrifice one out of every 10 to the Lord to fulfill his promise. And I believe that's what he's going back to Bethel to, the very place where he made the promise. God is calling him back there to fulfill the promise. And he realizes now he's going to have to really get everything right with God. He's going to get the idols out of his house. He's got to make sure he doesn't have any dirty laundry when he shows up there, because he's going to meet God again in the place where he first met him, and he's going to really have to do business seriously with God and keep his promises. Verse 5, "And they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were all around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob." At the end of the previous chapter, Jacob expressed his concern that the Canaanites, hearing of what had happened at Shechem, would be angry and fearful, and would gang up and come after him and wipe him out. And they would have, apparently, except the Bible says God didn't permit them. He put the fear of God on all those cities around about, so they didn't come after him. Which tells us, of course, that the security of a nation or of a people is more dependent on God showing favor to them than not. There's no reason in the natural that these nations should have been intimidated by Jacob. He had a lot of servants, but he didn't. But he acknowledged himself. He had a lot fewer than the nations around him did, and they could have outnumbered him. It's not that he had a superior military machine that kept him secure. It was that God was on his side. Why God was on his side is nowhere explained. You know, he's not a particularly great man in terms of godliness, but God has made a commitment to him, and God therefore puts the fear of God on the nations that would be hostile to him so that they're not. The Bible says in Proverbs that when a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with them. And when Christians feel that national security depends upon a strong military, perhaps it does if a nation is ungodly. Because if a nation is ungodly and God is not pleased with them, then they better have in the form of invasion from other nations could easily come on them. It's historically the case when God wants to judge a wicked nation, he brings another army against them and does so, even if it's Israel or Judah later on in history. He brings the Babylonians or the Assyrians. If America is a corrupt nation and God wished to judge it, then he could bring someone like Saddam Hussein shooting nuclear warheads over here or China at some point in the near future. There could be a judgment on this nation if we are wicked. And a wicked nation has nothing to protect it except its military. And so as long as people are not in right relationship with God, nations apparently need strong military. When they are in right relationship with God, that doesn't mean that a strong military will hurt them any. There are times when Israel, in favor with God, fought wars and won them, but it never depended on a superior military force. Gideon's a good example of that fact. And the fact that God told later on in Deuteronomy Moses that the kings of Israel should not multiply their military machine. They should not go down to Egypt to multiply horses and so forth and chariots. Was to suggest that they should never become dependent on that, but they should become dependent on God. It is clear that if Christians say, well, if we don't have the Star Wars program, if we don't have, if we don't maintain nuclear superiority over the major world powers that are hostile toward us, how would we ever be secure? And the question is, how indeed? Certainly we would not be secure because we're an ungodly nation and can expect the judgment of God. But there is an alternative. And that would be to be a godly nation, to be a nation that God favors, to be people who honor God. I don't see that happening anytime soon in this country, but God may have some surprises for us. I hope he might. I hope they're of a positive sort. But I'm saying that if the nation were a godly nation, the size of the military would become insignificant. Because if the ways of a man please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. Not so much that the enemies love him, but in this case, for example, the enemies didn't love Jacob, but God put his fear on them and they didn't come after him. They would have, but God wouldn't let them. And there's every reason to believe that this is the same God who operates today on behalf of his people if they please him. And our security is in God, hopefully, not in the military. We as Christians, anyway. The country may be in trouble, but we, if we focus on living a life pleasing to God, then our own personal security, at least, can be assured. So Jacob came to Luz, that is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, and he and all the people who were with him. And he built an altar before, there, and called the place El Bethel, which means God of Bethel. And Bethel itself means house of God. Beth means house. El means God in Hebrew. Because there God appeared to him when he had fled from the face of his brother. Now Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died. And she was buried now below Bethel under the terebinth tree. So the name of it was called Alon Bakuth, which means the terebinth tree of weeping, because of the weeping over Rebekah's nurse. Now, this statement is rather perplexing. How did Rebekah's nurse happen to be in Jacob's entourage? This is not Rachel's nurse or Leah's nurse, or even Jacob's nurse, it's Rebekah's nurse. This is presumably the woman who attended to Rebekah, Jacob's mother, whom he has not seen for years, as far as we know. And why is Rebekah's nurse not with Rebekah? Why is Rebekah's nurse with Jacob and his family? And how is it she came to join him? She didn't flee with him from Esau 20 years earlier. He didn't take Rebecca, his mother's nurse, with him when he went to Laban's house. When did she join the company here? There is no answer given in Scripture, but it certainly implies something, and that is that we have a very sketchy account of all that happened. There must have been a visit by Jacob back to his father's house. It has not been recorded, by the way. Remember when he was fleeing from Laban, Laban says, I understand you want to go back to your father's house. I can see you're homesick. Well, we never read ever of Jacob going back and visiting Isaac at all, his father. But he must have done so. It seems unthinkable that he would not. He would at least want to go back and see if his mother was still living. I think that the evidence would probably suggest a scenario something like this, that somewhere unrecorded in the narrative, probably shortly after he came back into the land of Canaan, he actually went to the place where his family lived and did visit his father and probably found that his mother had died. And her nurse, therefore, had no assignment, because her nurse had been assigned to her during her lifetime. Once she's dead, there's nothing more for her nurse to do, so that the nurse joined Jacob's troop and traveled to be a nurse perhaps to the women of that family. Very probably, when you say Rebecca's nurse, that a nurse could even mean a wet nurse. It could be someone who nursed the babies. In important families, in royal families and so forth, often the queen doesn't nurse her own babies. In some societies, the chief's wife don't nurse their own babies. They have slaves or servants, women who nurse the babies on their own breasts. And it's possible that Rebecca's nurse had actually been the woman who had suckled both Jacob and Esau in their infancy. A woman who goes way back in the family. And probably Rebecca had died. And Rebecca didn't need a nurse anymore, therefore. And so the nurse had joined this troop and traveled with them, and at this point died. I'm simply reading between the lines because we have to read something there. When did Rebecca's nurse happen to come to be with this family? We don't know. Either she came by herself or they went and picked her up, because she wasn't with them at first when they fled from Laban's house. Then God appeared to Jacob again, verse 9, and when he came from Paddan Aram, and blessed him. And God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be called Jacob anymore, but Israel shall be your name." So he called his name Israel. Also God said to him, "I am God Almighty, El Shaddai. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings shall come from your body. The land which I gave Abraham and Isaac I give to you, and to your descendants after you I give this land." Then God went up from him in the place where he talked with him. So Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, a pillar of stone, and he poured a drink offering on it, and he poured oil on it. And Jacob called the name of the place where God spoke with him Bethel. As we can see, God simply repeated things to him on this occasion that had been said earlier. But it was decades earlier, and so God reiterated them, just so that he wouldn't be forgetful of the promises that were upon him from God. Now verse 16. Then they journeyed from Bethel, and when there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath, which is another name for the town of Bethlehem, Rachel travailed in childbirth, and she had hard labor. Now she only had one child prior to this, that was Joseph. So now she's in labor with her second child. Now it came to pass, when she was in hard labor, that the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, you will have this son also." And so it was, as her soul was departing, for she died, that she called his name Ben-Oni, but his father called him Benjamin. Ben-Oni means son of my sorrow, and Benjamin means son of my right hand. Son of my right hand would mean a son of special favor to his father. And at the right hand is the place of favor in Hebrew culture. And so Rachel did give Jacob his 12th son, but she died in childbirth. And she gave him a name, a sad name, but Jacob renamed him. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. And Jacob set a pillar on her grave, which is the pillar of Rachel's grave to this day. she did not get buried in Machpelah, unlike Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, and Jacob and Leah, who were buried at Machpelah. Rachel was not. Now, this was simply a matter of logistics. She died too far away from there to be transported there for burial. But we could also say in the sovereignty of God, God did not allow her to come to burial with Jacob. And it's one of those several things I mentioned earlier that I think may indicate that Leah was God's choice of a wife for Jacob, not Rachel. Rachel was Jacob's preference on grounds, no other grounds than physical attraction. And there's even some little dialogue between Jacob and Rachel recorded, all of which is rather hostile, rather stormy. And we saw earlier that Leah had much more of a piety and a greater natural interest in Jehovah. And God brought forth the ancestor of the Messiah through Leah. And Leah eventually was buried with Jacob, but Rachel was not. These things may be indicators of God's intention toward Jacob's family, that he intended Leah, not Rachel, to be the wife. Now, later on, Jeremiah, in chapter 31 or 30, I forget which, speaks of a time of Rachel weeping because her children are not. And Jeremiah, the statement seems to apply to the removal of the Jews from the land of Judah into Babylon, which is what Jeremiah is predicting. And figuratively speaking, Rachel, who is buried in that region, is weeping because the children have been removed. But Matthew actually takes that verse and applies it to the slaughter of the infants by Herod. And that's Jeremiah 31:15. But Matthew applies it in Matthew 2, verse 17. When Herod slew the infants in Bethlehem, it says, "Then was fulfilled what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, A voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation, weeping, and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they were no more." Matthew thinks this to be particularly applicable to the slaughter of the infants in Bethlehem for the simple reason that Rachel was buried near Bethlehem. This slaughter took place in Bethlehem of the infants by Herod. And because Rachel was nearby, Matthew, by inspiration of the Holy Spirit, pictures her, as it were, weeping in her grave over the loss of these children. It's similar probably to the figure of speech that we'd say someone would turn over in their grave. George Washington would turn over in his grave if he saw what had become of this country, people might say. That's not literal. It simply means that it's just a figure, and that Rachel was near to Bethlehem when she died and buried near there, so the later slaughter of infants there is thought by Matthew to be an occasion for her to weep in her grave nearby. Now, verse 21, Genesis 35:21. Then Israel journeyed and pitched his tent beyond the tower of Eder. And it happened when Israel dwelt in that land that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard about it, but once again did nothing about it. This matter of sleeping with Jacob's concubine, Bilhah, which was Rachel's servant previously, was actually a case of a son sleeping with his father's wife, something very strictly forbidden later on in the law of Moses. It was punishable by death, and it was, of course, socially totally unacceptable even before the law came along to forbid it. In fact, in the New Testament times, Paul indicates in 1 Corinthians 5 that such an action, a man sleeping with his father's wife, was a thing unheard of even among the corrupt Greeks who were not Christians, the pagan Greeks who had prostitutes in their temples that they consorted with as part of the worship of their gods. I mean, the Corinthians were of about the lowest moral nature of any society in Paul's time, totally without the slightest vestige of Christian morals. And yet in Corinth, a man was having a relationship with his father's wife, and Paul said, this is even unheard of among the heathen. This is so ghastly that even the immoral, corrupt Grecians, who generally had extremely corrupt views of sexual morality, they would be aghast at this. So Reuben, although he lived before the law, was not doing something that he didn't know was wrong. Human societies instinctively know this, even if they have very little moral sense. Reuben, like Simeon and Levi, should have been put to death for this. At a later time, Absalom slept with his father David's concubines, and his sentence was death. Of course, God executed that sentence rather than man, but it's a total act of rebellion against the father. Now, why did Reuben do this? It's really hard to say. Rachel had just died. Her concubine was at once the father's consort, but also had been the servant of Rachel. And maybe, I don't know, maybe he thought he could take advantage of this situation. Maybe it was an act of contempt toward Rachel. But of course, it ended up being an act of contempt toward his father. Remember, Reuben was the son of Leah, and not of Rachel. And therefore, there may have been tremendous hostility on the part of Leah's sons toward Rachel, just as there was hostility between Rachel and Leah themselves. We don't know what all the dynamics were. It is mentioned only very briefly. It is not like a Hollywood movie that would make this the major scene of the story. It is passed over in a single verse. But what is noticeable is that it says Israel, the father, heard about it, but he did nothing. It's like David when he heard that that Amnon had raped Tamar. He heard about it. It says he was angry, but he did nothing. These are ineffectual fathers who do nothing. Well, he didn't do anything immediately, at least. Later on in chapter 49, when Jacob is passing out the birthright blessings, he says to Reuben, you're not it. You may be my firstborn, but you have forfeited the birthright. You are unstable as water. You will never excel. And basically, because of this little event, passed over in a single verse in the narrative, it is not forgotten. Years, decades later, Reuben probably figured he got away with it. He did it. To his embarrassment, it was found out. His father heard of it. His father, no doubt, was extremely angry about it, but did nothing. And time went on, and Reuben probably just felt like, well, it's water under the bridge. It's all over. I mean, that I got away with it. I had my moment of passion, and I've suffered no consequences for it. However, he was naive to think that, because it was years later when on his father's deathbed, his father said, because you did that, you lose the birthright. Reuben didn't know until much later what the consequences of his sin would be, and probably lived in the false delusion that he had really gotten away with something. And of course, that's the picture of the sinner in general. It says in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the hearts of the sons of men are fully set in them to do evil. That is Ecclesiastes 8:11. Because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. They don't get punished right away. So they figure, hey, I got away with it. So they just establish a pattern of this kind of behavior, and they don't realize that punishment is coming. It's just been not immediate. Ecclesiastes 8:11. And Reuben found out years later that he was penalized, severely penalized, not as severely as he deserved, but enough to be a great disappointment to him for this act that he probably in the meantime felt like had just kind of disappeared, because time heals all wounds, and time does not cover all sins. Time itself doesn't change a sinful past. And he never repented, as far as we know. Now the sons of Jacob were 12. Verse 23, the sons of Leah were Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. The sons of Rachel were Joseph and Benjamin. The sons of Bilhah, Rachel's maid, were Dan and Naphtali. And the sons of Zilpah, Leah's maidservant, were Gad and Asher. These were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Padan Aram. Now, some have felt there's a contradiction in the Bible here because it says these were the sons that were born in Paddan Aram. And yet we just read that Benjamin, who is mentioned in verse 24, was not born in Paddan Aram. He was born after the return to Canaan. And he was born near Bethlehem in Judah, in the region that later was Judah. And so he wasn't born in Paddan Aram. And here we have a contradiction. Not so. The narrative simply means to imply that this family grew, these children were born, for the most part, in Paddan Aram. Of course, it's just told us one of them was not. It's not, the author's not contradicting himself. He expects the reader to be astute enough to realize that, with the exception of one of these sons were born in Paddan Aram. I mean, the exception has been mentioned only about five verses earlier. It's hardly likely that the reader is expected to be so stupid as to mistakenly think that Benjamin was born in Paddan Aram, or to think that the statement in verse 26 is affirming that he was. It's simply indicating that these sons, with one exception implied, which is stated earlier in the chapter, were born in Paddan Aram. Verse 27, then Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre, or Kirjath Arba, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had sojourned. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years. So this is, Jacob had left Laban's house when he was 97. So it's been a good 83 years that he's been back in the land. It's not likely that he waited those full 83 years to visit his father. His father apparently had seen him much earlier, but now he visits him again because Isaac is this time really dying. So Isaac breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, being old and full of days, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. So, it's interesting. Earlier, we read of the death of Abraham, and in chapter 25, we saw that Ishmael and Isaac, who had prior to that been had not been all that friendly to each other, that they joined together to bury their father. It says in chapter 25, verse 9, and his sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in a cave at Machpelah. Well, having mentioned Ishmael again there in chapter 25 at the burial of his father, chapter 25 goes on to give a genealogy of Ishmael, a little bit of Ishmael's offspring, and then to dismiss him entirely from the narrative. This is the same thing happening with Esau. Esau appears here to bury his father, and then that he might be finally dismissed from the narrative, a chapter is given. Chapter 36 is a chapter which is there for no reason but to tell us what became of Esau and his family, who came from him, and so forth. So we have chapter 36 is one of the chapters that I feel most comfortable not taking verse by verse. Because what we have is nothing, there's absolutely nothing in chapter 36 except a catalog of the persons who descended from Esau. Now, I'm not saying none of these are important. I want to make a few comments. But largely, the names that occupy these verses are names of people we know absolutely nothing about, except what we're told here. They were born from this person. And there is no personal history about these people known. They do not become significant, with the exception of the fact that the Edomites, who came from Esau, were later an enemy nation of Israel, and in many times in later history they come into the picture in wars with Israel, and God shows great contempt for the nation of Edom in later prophets and condemns them a great deal. But this is telling us how the family of Esau developed into the kingdom of the Edomites. It says, now this is the genealogy of Esau, who is Edom. Esau took his wives from the daughters of Canaan: Ada, the daughter of Elon the Hittite; Aholibamah, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibeon the Hivite; and Basemath, Ishmael's daughter, sister of Nebajoth. Now Ada bore Eliphaz to Esau, and Basemath bore Reuel. And Aholibamah bore Jeush, Jaalam, and Korah, not to be confused with the Korah later that was contemporary with Moses. These were the sons of Esau who were born to him in the land of Canaan. Then Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all the persons of his household, his cattle, and all his animals, and all his goods which he had gained in the land of Canaan, and went to a country away from the presence of his brother Jacob. For their possessions were too great for them to dwell together, a little like Abraham and Lot back in chapter 13. They were just too wealthy to really share the pasture land. They had too many flocks. And the land where they were strangers could not support them because of their livestock. So Esau dwelt in Mount Seir. And we're told again, just as we were in verse 1, verse 8 tells us, Esau is Edom. Mount Seir was a region that earlier was controlled by a pagan people called the Horites. The Edomites at some point in time, and we don't know exactly when this happened chronologically, but the Edomites conquered the Horites, drove them out, just as the Jews later did with the Canaanites, and took Mount Seir as their place of their country. Their capital at one point later was a city called Petra, which was a rocky, craggy cliff city, actually carved into the rock hillsides where the dwelling places and so forth. And it was a very easily defended city. So it was only accessible through a narrow ravine, which the inhabitants of Edom could easily defend against invaders. And so the Edomites at a later date really thought themselves invincible because their city of Petra was so impregnable. But actually, in the book of Obadiah later on, God predicts that the Edomites will come to total, utter judgment, and Petra, their rock city, will be destroyed. And it did happen in pre-Christian times. Prior to the birth of Christ, the Nabataeans and some other wandering Arab nomadic types came in waves and conquered the Edomites. And there were very few Edomites left in the days of Jesus. In fact, historians say the last known Edomite in history was Herod the Great, who was himself only half Edomite. He had a Jewish mother, I believe, and an Edomite father. And so the Edomite race of Esau continued barely up until the time of Christ. Herod was alive when Jesus was born, but died when Jesus was a baby. So the end of the Edomite line coincides pretty much with the birth of Jesus and the fulfillment of God's promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in bringing the seed who would inherit the land. Coinciding with the fulfillment of God's promises to Jacob is the actual end of the historic line of Esau. Now, verse 9 says, "This is the genealogy of Esau, the father of the Edomites at Mount Seir. These were the names of his sons: Eliphaz, the son of Ada, the wife of Esau; Reuel, the son of Basemath, the wife of Esau. And the sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, Zepho, Gatam, and Kenaz. And Timnah was the concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bore Amalek to Eliphaz. These were the sons of Ada, Esau's wife." Now, I read these verses. I won't read all the verses, but these names are important, some of them. Eliphaz, we don't know who Eliphaz was except that he was a son of Esau, but later on, Job had a friend by this name. In fact, Eliphaz, Job's friend, was called Eliphaz the Temanite. And in verse 11, we see that there's a man named Teman who was descended from Esau. So the Temanites apparently were from Esau. That means that one of Job's friends was a Temanite and bore the family name of Eliphaz, and therefore was an Edomite, came from Edom. We find also in verse 12, Amalek was born in this line, and the Amalekites were later enemies of the Jews. And in fact, they came under an exceptional curse that God told King Saul, the first king of Israel, to go out and exterminate all the Amalekites. Amalek was an unusually wicked enemy of the Jews at a later date and came under an extreme curse more than most pagan nations did. Now I'm going to skip down to verse 15. "These were the chiefs of the sons of Esau. The sons of Eliphaz, the firstborn son of Esau, were chief Teman, from whom apparently the Temanites came, chief Omar, chief Zepho, and chief Kenaz, chief Korah, chief Gatam, chief Amalek. These were the chiefs of Eliphaz in the land of Edom, and they were the sons of Ada. These were the sons of Reuel, Esau's son." Give some names. I don't think we have any names there we need to know about. And verse 18, "These were the sons of Aholibamah, Esau's wife,
Chief Jeush, and we're going to name their daughter Aholibama. It's a good old Bible name. These were the chiefs who descended from Aholibama, Esau's wife, the daughter of Anah. Verse 19, these were the sons of Esau, who is Edom, and these were their chiefs. Chiefs, apparently in the sense of tribal or clan leaders, you know, just like Jacob's 12 sons became the what we call patriarchs, or the fathers, or the heads of 12 tribes. So that the man Judah, his family becomes the tribe of Judah. The man Issachar, his family becomes the tribe of Issachar. All the 12 sons of Jacob, or of Israel, became the 12 tribes of Israel. And so also Esau's sons became tribal heads, or chiefs, as they're called here. And it tells us what the names of the chiefs were. In all likelihood, these were, you know, like tribal names that came from within the Edomites, like the Temanite or the Amalekites. Okay, now verse 20. These were the sons of Seir the Horite, who inhabited the land. Now, what we have here in verses 20 through 30, we don't have to read these names. They're all people of no great importance, with the exception that in verse 28, Uz is mentioned. I say this because Job was a man who lived in the land of Uz. Once again, connecting Job with the Edomite setting. One of his friends was Eliphaz the Temanite, obviously descended from Esau. Job was a man who lived in the land of Uz. Uz was actually one of the sons, or one of the persons of the Horite people. Apparently, when the Edomites conquered the region, Uz was a Horite name, and was the name of a town that Job lived in. So we can pretty much determine that Job lived in the region of Edom. Although it is not stated as such in the book of Job, there are these hints to it. There's more, though. In verse 31, now these were the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the children of Israel. Now let me say this. In saying before any king reigned over the children of Israel, this has been found to be what some people would call an anachronism. Something that is in the wrong time frame. Because the critics of the Bible say, wait a minute, Moses supposedly wrote the book of Genesis, right? Well, Moses did not live to see any kings reign in Israel. Yet the writer seems to know of a time when kings reigned in Israel. Because he says these kings that he's about to list reigned over Edom before any of the kings reigned over the children of Israel. Suggesting to the mind of the critic that the writer of this must have been acquainted with the kings of Israel. And those kings did not arise in the days of Moses or even in the days of Joshua or of the judges, but after that in the time of Samuel. And therefore this is thought to be an evidence that Genesis could not have been written by Moses. Now there's two possible solutions to this. Neither of them are very desperate solutions. They're quite simple. One is that in Deuteronomy chapter 17, Moses predicted that the Jews would have kings. They did not come into existence in his time, but he prophesied that the time would come when they would demand a king for themselves and that they would appoint kings over them. Therefore, Moses knew a time would come when Israel would have kings. And though he didn't live to see it, he could predict that such would happen. Now, in that case, he could easily say, these kings ruled in Edom before there were any kings in Israel. Because they were there in Moses' time. And he knew that that was before Israel had any kings. And later generations would then recognize the antiquity of these Edomite kings as being there before the Israel's kings were reigning. Now, another explanation of this is, and it's entirely possible, remember when we say that Moses is substantially the author of the Pentateuch, there's no reason to affirm, nothing in the New Testament or in the books of Moses affirm that Moses wrote every word, or that we have the Pentateuch in exactly the form that Moses wrote it. It was brought down to us through his successors. Joshua and the judges and Samuel and so forth must have transmitted Moses' work to us, and there's no reason why one of these inspired writers couldn't have put in occasional comments. like the comment in the book of Numbers, that Moses was the meekest man on the face of the earth. There's no need to believe that Moses wrote that line about himself, although it appears in one of his books. As I said earlier, in the comments, it says, the Canaanites were then in the land. It's possible that Moses could have written that, but it's also possible that a later writer, like Joshua, could have added that in. There's no reason to believe that another inspired writer couldn't have updated the book or added editorial comments that were helpful to the readers, and that would not change the fact that substantially the material was written by Moses, but that other editors had had their hand in it, other inspired editors. It would not in any way endanger our understanding of the authority or inspiration of this book. So either way, actually Moses could have written this line, but if anyone thinks it unlikely that Moses would have written a line like this, there's also the possibility that a later writer, Samuel, or someone handling the text, might have put that in there. Samuel is a prophet, just like Moses was. Why couldn't he contribute to the Word of God? He did, anyway. He wrote books. He may have added some to this book. Now, there are names of these kings of Edom. I don't want to call your attention to any of them in particular, just because they're not all that important. But I will point out that in verse 33, one of these kings or chiefs in Edom was called Jobab, the son of Zerah of Bozrah, who reigned in the place of Bela when he died. Now, Jobab, this is not necessarily universally agreed upon among scholars, but it has been suggested, the possibility is that Jobab is Job. We've already seen reason to associate Job with this region. He was in the land of Uz. Uz was in the land of the Horites, which the Edomites later occupied. One of Job's friends was a Temanite. Well, if he was a neighbor of his, he must have been in the land of Edom. Now, a man named Jobab, which is extremely close to the name Job, is found here as one of the kings ruling in one of the territories of Edom, in Bozrah, which became later a very important city in Edomite society. Of Job, it is said, in the opening verses of that book, although it does not identify his nationality directly, it certainly indicates that he was more than ordinarily important and powerful. It says in Job 1:1, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. That man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and shunned evil. And it says in verse 3, also his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, a very large household, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. Now, it might be a hyperbole to say he was the greatest, or it might be literal, that he was the literal greatest in terms of his power and wealth of all the people of the East. Whether it is hyperbole or whether it is literal, it certainly makes him out to be among the most significant, powerful, wealthy men of the region that he lived in. He lived in, apparently, the region of Edom. If he was one of the most powerful, maybe the most powerful man of his day in that region, he may well have been the king. We can't be sure, but Jobab in Genesis 36:33 might well be identified with Job. I have read that the name Jobab means something like one who howls loudly or something like that, which might also connect a little bit with the man Job in the story. Well, after talking about these kings of the Edomites, in verses 31 through 39, we have just a few verses at the end, verses 40 through 43, that gives the chiefs, I think the King James says the dukes or something like that, of the Edomites. I'm not sure what the difference is between the kings and the chiefs, but there are names given. None of their names, to tell you the truth, these chiefs are the same chiefs that were mentioned earlier. Excuse me. They were mentioned in verses 15 through 19 already, and it gives again their names at the end. Apparently the chiefs, as I say, are probably tribal heads, like the sons of Jacob were the heads of tribes. Later on there were kings in these tribes, but chiefs were the progenitors of each tribe, or the founders of the tribe, the patriarchs of the tribes. Well, With this chapter, we dispense really with any consideration of Esau further. He is no longer in the story or important. He may not have died immediately at this point. He may not have died before the events of chapter 37, but he simply isn't important enough to be part of the continuing story. In chapter 37, we're introduced to Joseph. Actually, we knew of Joseph's birth. We read of it earlier, but now we read of his story. And from chapter 37 to the end of Genesis, we will find that Joseph is the hero. For some unusual reason, chapter 38 is not about Joseph. Chapter 37 carries the story of Joseph up through the point where he's sold into slavery. The story is picked up in Egypt in chapter 39 and continues to the end of the book of Genesis. But it is interrupted in chapter 38 by a little story about Judah and his children. And we don't have similar stories about Reuben or Simeon or Issachar or Zebulun or Naphtali or Gad or Dan. We only have this story about Judah. Now you might say, well, probably the reason for that is because Judah's important. Judah, you know, David descended from Judah. Jesus descended from Judah. That's why it's there. I think you're right if you say that. I think that is why it's there. What's amazing, though, is that the writer of Genesis didn't know about Jesus yet. I mean, didn't know much about him. He knew about prophecies about him. But Jesus had not been born at the time this was written, nor for that matter had David been born at the time this was written. It is God who knew that David and Jesus would come through the tribe of Judah, and therefore that Judah's children would be important enough to record, even though the children of other big tribes don't receive similar attention. So it's sort of the Holy Spirit foreseeing that Judah would be an important player in producing the Messiah, and prior to that, the king after God's own heart, David, who supplied a dynasty for Judah forever afterward. The Holy Spirit foreseeing this decided not to let the story of Judah pass without mention of how his children came into the world, because these children are in the ancestry of Jesus. But that was foreseen back when Genesis was written, and so that Judah alone is selected. Now, if someone says, well, that's not all that miraculous because Judah is known to have had the birthright, that's true. That's true. And that is probably why Moses knew that Judah would be important enough to the Messiah would come through the one with the birthright. That's Judah. And so in chapter 38, we will sort of interrupt the story of Joseph in order to get some detail about the birth of Judah's children. It's an interesting story. And then we'll go back to the story of Joseph after that. It's not even entirely clear how the story of Judah in chapter 38 coincides chronologically with the story of Joseph. It may be that it happened at the very time that is inserted, or it might be parenthetical. But we'll consider these things at another time, because we simply don't have time to look at that in this session. We will come back to chapter 37 and begin the story of Joseph next time. All right? So we'll close with that.